In the last 6 weeks or so, I've been teaching a lot. I have taught 3 one-week retreats and finished last Monday, two of them at Spirit Rock and one at Cloud Mountain in Oregon. And I've been reflecting a lot on a theme, particularly, I think, during the last retreat, which was a loving-kindness or metta retreat. I've been reflecting a lot on one of the themes of our practice, which I've come to call the thinning of the self. And this is more in the sense of the opening to experience without so much of the influence of our usual sense of self. It's not about weight loss. And I'm conscious that the name of the talk, Thinning of the Self, could be misleading. We don't advertise so much about weight loss in our, like at Spirit Rock and elsewhere, but in actuality, when people are mindful, especially on retreats, it's possible to lose weight. Because, for example, I've taken as a practice very often during meals, I don't eat when I'm full. And I've always lost 5 pounds a month. But I'm not going to talk about that. This is a different sense of thinning the self. And what I want to talk about is the first of all, why this is both an important and a challenging topic, and often a confusing topic. And then mostly I want to talk very practically. This is, in a way, is an exploration of the theme of anatta, sometimes translated as not self, which I think can be very confusing when we explore it conceptually a lot. So I'm going to explore it primarily practically by pointing to 4 ways that we can practice and explore this sense of thinning of the self. The first is by exploring experiences of flow, much like we did at the end of the sitting. The second is by seeing where the self looks like it's strong, or to continue the metaphor of thinning, to see where the self feels thick, and to study those times. The third is to look at various ways of further thinning the self. These are all practical. And then the last is to particularly look at the opening to a kind of pure awareness as a way of being and knowing in which the self has been thinned out. Those are the four areas, plus a little bit of introduction. And all of those 4 areas point to practices, which I think is the best way to look at this topic. And it is, admittedly, often a very confusing topic. Sometimes in my role as a teacher, when I hear people ask questions about not self, I notice my body contracting in small ways. And that they're often framed more intellectually or theoretically, which I don't think is the best way to look at this topic. That being said, I think most of you know that the aim of insight meditation is to have insight, and the insights are specified in 3 main areas. You know, what do we have insight about in insight meditation? It's first to know impermanence. These are the so-called 3 characteristics. And very central in text. We're invited to really look carefully at impermanence. Secondly, what often is the main area of insight is to look at where there is suffering, which we often understand as reactivity as opposed to simply the unpleasant. Suffering in the sense of reacting, you know, and in the teaching that I often like to give, the teaching of the second arrow. Not the, the first arrow is the unpleasant, but then we react because of the unpleasant. And that, strictly speaking, is suffering. And when we talk about overcoming suffering, we're talking not so much about getting rid of the unpleasant, which is impossible, but rather transforming our tendencies to be reactive, actually both about the pleasant, the unpleasant, and the pleasant, and to be able to just be more present without reactivity. And then the last area of insight is called anatta. The first is anicca, the second is dukkha, and the third is anatta, which means not self, often translated as no self. I think incorrectly or inadequately, and just for purposes of etymology, in Sanskrit and Pali, the prefix A has the same function as it does in English, which means not, like atypical or amoral. It has the same meaning. So it doesn't mean no self, it means not self, which is, I've heard one teacher say, so much difference just with one consonant, difference of meaning. Because it can get very confusing. You know, I heard a story from some friends who were on a retreat. And there was this young man who was 20 years old, who was a student, who heard the teaching that there was no self. He had a very strong reaction to being at the retreat. I think he dropped out of school. He was extremely angry. I think he left the retreat to hear that there was no self. It messed up his plans. And he had a very strong reaction. Actually, I don't know what happened, but it was a very strong reaction. And it's a, you know, it's a very confusing territory. It was confusing for him in that instance. It's very confusing. The language that's used is very confusing. You know, in some spiritual language, we hear talk about finding the true self. So we have, in Buddhist tradition, we're asked to practice not self. In other traditions, we're asked to find the true self. In some approaches, we're looking for the self with a capital S. You know, there are a lot of confusions because of how self is used in Western psychology, and sometimes it's thought that the teaching of not self means getting rid of the ego, whatever that is. You know, so it gets very confusing, and you know, it's used so many different ways in Western psychology, concepts of self, and ego is actually a bad translation from the German of Freud. It's a very, because Freud's sense of what he was talking about was more like a sense of self, which doesn't have to do with being egotistical. So anyway, so you see where we could go if we were being more theoretical. Maybe there's already confusion, right? And then I could say also there are all sorts of complexities, like there are developmental issues. As you know, some psychologists have said you can't go beyond the self until you have a self. Right? We sometimes find people who are practicing meditation who actually don't have well-developed selves. And they confuse the teaching of not-self with meaning that they don't need a job. Or they don't need to be more grounded in experience. So you see, there are a lot of complexities here. And can be a lot of confusions. And there are confusions just by the way it's actually treated in Buddhist tradition. Sometimes you find in the text the word for someone who's very developed, and the word is maha-atta, which means great self, which is the Pali version, and it's the same word that's used for Gandhi. Mahatma. Gandhi means great self, more in Sanskrit. So not self equals great self. And then even that, you have places where the Buddha seems to suggest that the teaching of not self is not the last word. There's a famous dialogue with a wandering yogin named Vachagata. And the beginning of this text goes like this. The wanderer Vachagata approached the Buddha and said to him, "How is it now, Master Gotama? Is there a self?" When this was said, the Buddha was silent. "Then, Mr. Gotama, is there no self?" A second time, the Blessed One was silent. Then the wanderer Vachagota rose from his seat and departed. And we don't know what happened. But the Buddha, and then his attendant Ananda said, "Why didn't you answer him?" And he said, "If I had said there is a self, he would have gone to one extreme of thinking there's a solid self separate from everything. If I had gone with the answer and said there's no self, he would have gone to the other extreme." And so there's a kind of a pointing to a middle way or something beyond the extremes. And then, you know, in their contemporary teachers like Ajahn Chah, who, when they're asked about self or not self, they say, "The teachings about not self are not true. The teachings of self are not true." So you see, if we would have the rest of this talk be more theoretical, you might have an angry self develop or a confused self develop. And so I'm going to be practical. And I think what actually some of these answers are basically saying you'll find the answer to this question more in experience than in thinking about it. Okay? So I'm going to talk about it in these four ways. And what I have found in teaching and in my own experience, that the best way really to understand this teaching of not self, which is, I think, really, if we could say it conceptually, it's really about the way that a separate, independent self is not a valid way to approach the world. It's a misunderstanding. We could say sometimes that it's a teaching about interdependence, but the actual experience that I think is a very helpful one to point to what this teaching is about is what could be called and has been called an experience of being in the flow. I think the word was coined by the Hungarian psychologist Csikszentmihalyi. I think that's, I'm not sure that's pronounced correctly. But he pointed to these experiences of flow, and I find this a very wonderful way to talk about anatta or not self. And this is really pointing to the way that in our everyday experiences, we often experience a sense of being in the flow where there's little or no sense of self. And this can come in very ordinary activities. It can come when we're immersed in an activity, you know, and we're just immersed in our work, and there's not a sense of self. We're just doing that work. You know, and I know for me, and when we're really immersed, it can be quite a profound experience. I know for me, one of the first times I experienced this was when I was a student, and I stayed up much of the night to write an essay, which I didn't usually do, but that particular night I did, and I was just so immersed, like hours, probably 3, 4, 5 hours, totally immersed, no sense of time, no sense of self, just immersed in the creative process. And there was something quite profound. I remember coming and going into the dawn, and I was definitely in an altered state. You know, and I imagine most of us have experienced something like this. You know, it can appear in the creative process as an artist or a musician. We can have that experience, you know, where there's not a sense of self-consciousness. You know, the jazz musician who says, "That was a really cool riff," is not in the moment, right? is not in the flow. And flow is often used as a metaphor in jazz. This is from Chuang Tzu. In the Taoist tradition, there's a very similar notion of Wu Wei, which is understood as non-action, which is, again, is a sense of action and being without, we could say, a thick sense of self. And this is the text called The Woodcarver. King, the master carver, made a bell stand of precious wood. When it was finished, all who saw it were astonished. They said it must be the work of spirits. The Prince of Lu said to the master carver, "What is your secret?" King replied, "I am only a workman. I have no secret. There is only this. When I began to think about the work you commanded, I guarded my spirit and not expended on trifles that were not to the point. I fasted in order to act to set my heart at rest. After 3 days fasting, I had forgotten gain and success. After 5 days, I had forgotten praise or criticism. After 7 days, I had forgotten my body with all its limbs. By this time, all thoughts of your highness and of the court had faded away. All that might distract me from the work had vanished. I was collected in the single thought of the bell stand. Then I went to the forest to see the trees in their own natural state. When the right tree appeared before my eyes, the bell stand also appeared in it, clearly, beyond doubt. All I had to do was put forth my hand and begin. If I had not met this particular tree, there would have been no bell stand at all. What happened? My own collected thought encountered the hidden potential in the wood. From this live encounter came the work which you ascribe to the spirits." And I imagine we experience that again in the creative process. I remember talking with my mom, who is here, and she's a musician. And we were talking about meditation, and particularly about forms of concentrative meditation. And she said, "Music is my concentrative meditation." And then she said, "When you're performing, if there's a sense of self, it's not so good. You have to let yourself be taken over by the music." So there's a thinning of the self in creative processes. Again, music. One of my favorite group of examples comes from sports. I have a friend named Andrew Cooper, wrote this book called Playing in the Zone, which is subtitled Exploring the Spiritual Dimension of Sports. And I'll just read a few passages here from this book. It's really pointing to that sense of flow. This is the British golfer Tony Jacklin. "When I'm in this state, the cocoon of concentration, I'm living fully in the present, not moving out of it. I'm aware of every inch of my swing. I'm absolutely engaged, involved in what I'm doing at a particular moment. That's the important thing." That's the difficult state to arrive at, actually. It comes and it goes, and the pure fact that you go out on the first tee of a tournament and say, "I must concentrate today," is no good. It won't work. It has to already be there. Or this is from the Japanese baseball player Sadahiro Oh, one of the great players. He said, "The home runs rocketed off my bat almost as though a power beyond my own were responsible." And you can see that, and this book is full of stories like that. So we experience that sense of flow in ordinary activities where there's immersion. And we experience it in our relationships often, where there's no self-consciousness, no self-image, just with people we're connected to, we trust, people we love. In being with people like that, there's that sense of flow, not a sense of self. This, for me, is a very everyday, ordinary way to understand that sense of not self. It's not particularly mysterious in a sense. Or it is and it isn't, I should say. Right? it happens, you know, and there's a kind of thinning of the self in those moments. And we can also explore this in meditation, much like we did just for that short time at the end, where we can actually try to cultivate in meditation just being with the flow of experience as it's occurring, without really adding self, and then watching where the self occurs. So this is one whole area where we can explore this teaching of not-self. We can explore it by looking for those moments of flow and appreciating them, really, and sometimes inviting them in our activities. You know, can do it any activity as long as there's that full immersion. And then it's connected with the second area, which I'm calling really tracking the manifestations of a thick sense of self. This is a second whole area of practice for exploring anatta or not self. And that is to really track when there's a strong or thick sense of self. A lot of our practice is already like this, right? In fact, the practice we did earlier, that might have been there a lot, right? I'm sitting and I start thinking about this, and I think about it for 5 minutes, for 10 minutes. That is a manifestation of a thick sense of self. Not necessarily dramatic or hugely harmful, but there's a sense of self there. My preoccupation, my issue, and again, it's not negative in itself. It's partly there maybe because there's some unresolved issue that we want to attend to. So the thick sense of self can manifest in all sorts of ways. Again, as I suggested during the guided meditation, when we're really reactive. Studying my own reactivity is a fantastic way to study the thick sense of self and gradually move towards the thinning of the self. It's a big part of our practice, being really interested in when I lose it, when I'm reactive, when I'm grasping, when I'm pushing away. These are very important experiences, not to be simply thought of as bad experiences. Embrace one's own reactivity. Become a connoisseur, an expert on one's own reactivity. This is key to our practice, actually, because we get to study it, see it, and watch the narratives. What's the storyline? What's it feel like in the body? Really study that. And as we do that more, we learn about it, and we may, at a future time, get hooked less by the storyline, get hooked less. So there are many ways that we can study this thick self, and a lot of thinking and liking and disliking in reactivity. Some aspects of the thick sense of self only manifest when there are certain stimuli. You know, and we may be going along and someone says something and suddenly I get triggered, right? Because there's some of the aspects of the thick sense of self are connected with what's partly conscious or even unconscious. That's what makes it hard. We have to looking at the self sometimes takes going beneath the surface. Sometimes we do psychological work, you know, that we look for when things get triggered, right? We can have stuff beneath the surface, maybe related to some wound or some difficulty in the past, some conditioning, some trauma even. And that, you know, one of the, I think, great benefits of Western psychology is that it really gives a map, a lot of the places where there may be developmental arrests or sometimes wounds, and it gives a map of those, because those will manifest as a thick sense of self often. You know, I had issues when I was 8 years old, my parents divorced, and I have a deep belief beneath the surface that if I get close to someone, I will be abandoned. Often not there, but then when I'm in certain relationships, it comes up, right? And that is another form of the thick sense of self that can manifest only when it gets stimulated. So you can see it's a lot of work. There are also aspects of that thick sense of self which may be connected with social conditioning, with gender, or ethnicity, or level of education, our sense of self. And this gets tricky, right? So there's You can see the second area of looking for the thick sense of self can take a while, right? And some of it's not always apparent. It's beneath the surface, so there's a lot here in the second area, but we want to really keep looking in that way. Some of it we can do in meditation, some of it we need other ways to go beneath the surface. So it's a huge area to thin the self. And this third area that I'm pointing to is further ways, we might say, to thin the self. And that could manifest in a lot of different practices. I think our normal mindfulness practice, in many ways, is a practice to thin the self. We notice the thick self, we see it, and in a sense we let go. We don't keep thinking the thought. We don't keep following the narrative, the storyline, right? And so there's a way that we, in a way, let go of the thick self in the moment through our practice. That's one of the ways we thin the thick self. You know, having just taught loving kindness practice for a week, that practice is a beautiful practice for thinning. You know, where we really learn to care for ourselves and care for others, and it tends to thin the sense of being a separate self from others. So we can do inner practices like metta. This is from a beautiful text where the Buddha came to visit three monks who collectively were called the Aniruddhas. They only had one name, even though there were three monks. They took the name of the elder monk. And the Buddha said, "Hey, you Aniruddhas, how is it that you are living together on friendly terms and harmonious as milk and water, regarding each other with the eye of affection?" And the elder Aniruddha said, "We have been practicing loving kindness a lot. And we have been doing this in regard to body, speech, and mind. Dear Buddha, we have diverse bodies, but we have only one mind and heart," he said. This has been motivated by metta. We no longer prefer our own happiness to that of others through the practice of metta. And so a lot of the heart practices that we do with ourselves, with others, compassion, forgiveness, gratitude, all of these, I think, are practices with which we thin the self. And of course, a lot of our work, many of us are in the helping professions, and that work can definitely be a thinning of the self. We have more of a sense, as we work, of our minds and hearts being more and more similar. You know, and almost like there's one big mind and heart, and we're just helping, that we're not so different, you know. And we cut through, I think, what a lot of the social conditioning that's so thick. You know, it's like the context for this talk is the teaching of anatta, or not self, meets Western individualism. That's the social context, right? And so all of this is going against some pretty thick conditioning. And so a lot of our work, where we serve, where we help others, is going to be beautiful practice. We raise children, you know, we have relationships. All of these are practices where the self can be thinned. Another practice could be the practice of empathy. It's a beautiful practice to thin the self. It's a true sense of not self can develop, you know, and we've done empathy practice here a few times, and the simple form that I like to do personally, and that I've been teaching more in the context of communication, is the practice where we learn how to tune in to the feelings or emotions of another, and then the sense of what matters. And we can do this continually as a practice. You know, initially with people where it's not so difficult, and then increasingly where it's difficult. And that can be a form of practice where we're actually tuned in to another and have empathy towards another just as we do towards ourselves. This for me is a thinning of the self. It's actually, we're told by the scientists of the brain that this is actually the natural expression of our limbic system. Isn't it amazing to have the scientists tell us human beings are wired for compassion? And effectively, they don't say it quite like this. Human beings are wired for not self. Isn't that interesting? And it's our conditioning which gets in the way. Yeah. So there's a lot there. There are a lot of practices that can really help us to thin the self. And then the last area I wanted to talk about was this cultivation of awareness that is really beyond identification with any content of experience. And this is a teaching particularly in the Thai forest tradition, which is one of the lineages which we have as part of our background. Teachers like Achan Cha. Achan just means teacher. Achan Cha, who's a teacher of Jack Kornfield and whom I met and studied with briefly when he came to the U.S. And a lot of the great teachers, they have a core teaching there that there is what they call a primal awareness. They sometimes call it the radiant mind or the primal mind. And they point to a kind of awareness which doesn't actually have any clinging to a sense of self. It doesn't have any determination by the contents of experience. It's an awareness that the contents of experience come through it, but there's not an identification. It's not so different in some ways than the flow experience, right? Achan Cha said that he studied with his teacher, Achan Mun, who lived until about 1950 or so. He was just with him 3 days, but the core teaching was there is a quality of awareness which is separate from the contents of experience. The contents come through, they come and go, but there's an awareness which stays. And we can cultivate this. This is also found in other traditions and approaches. The teacher Deepa Ma, a Bengali woman who had a big influence on a lot of teachers. And I met her once. She actually stayed in my house for a little while. She died in the early 90s. And she was once asked by Jack Kornfield, what is there in your consciousness? And her answer was, there are only three things. Concentration, peace, and loving kindness. That's all that's there. And so we can cultivate that, this quality of awareness as well. I'll just finish with just a few readings about this. Let's see where they are. I'll finish with three short readings. One is from the Buddha. This is from the Dhammapada, pointing to this quality of awareness. He said, there are no footprints in the sky. You won't find the sage out there. There are no eternal conditioned things. Buddhas never waver. The constant awareness being pointed to. This is from Achan Mahabua, who died just a few years ago, who I was privileged to meet in Thailand. Who taught about this quality of awareness. He said, when dukkha is completely stopped, meaning there's no more reactivity, which we can experience for short times, certainly, and then have them get bigger. When dukkha is completely stopped, nothing remains. All that remains is an entirely pure awareness. This is not a noble truth. It's the purity of the mind and heart. You can call it what you want. Call it Nibbana or whatever you want. All I ask is that you know this marvelous, extraordinary quality of awareness. And then lastly, sort of practice instructions for this awareness from Ajahn Chah, and I'll finish with this. Just go into the room and put one chair in the center. Take the seat in the center of the room, open the doors and windows, and see who comes to visit. You will witness all kinds of scenes and actors, all kinds of temptations and stories imaginable. Your only job is to stay in your seat. You will see it all arise and pass, and out of this wisdom and understanding will come. As I see it, the mind is like a single point, the center of the universe, and mental states are like visitors who come to stay at this point for short or long periods of time. Get to know these visitors well. Become familiar with the vivid pictures they paint, the alluring stories they tell, to entice you to follow them. But do not give up your seat. It is the only chair around. If you continue to occupy it unceasingly, greeting each guest as it comes, firmly establishing yourself in awareness, transforming your mind into the one who knows, the one who is awake, the visitors will eventually stop coming back. If you give them real attention, how many times can these visitors return? Speak with them here and you will know every one of them well. Then your mind will at last be at peace. That's pointing to both an ordinary and an extraordinary quality of awareness that is accessible to us. What's hard is to have it last. It actually is there with some of the flow experiences. It's hard to have it last. The practice instruction is tune into an awareness and let go of the identification with the contents of experience. That's the practice instruction. That's what Ajahn Chah got from Ajahn Mun. He said, that was enough. Then I went and practiced for 7 years. Right? And so I'll finish now and just say that these are, for me, 4 ways of practicing that bring out the nature of not self, this teaching, very effectively. They're all accessible to us. The first is being with the flow experience, both noticing when it's there, because I think it's there a lot in our everyday lives, we just don't notice it, right? Tuning into it and then cultivating it, number one. Number two, tracking the thick sense of self in all the different ways it appears. That's a big part of our practice. We have to do it patiently, continually, with patience. And then the third is following these other practices that help thin the self further, to use that metaphor. And then the fourth is tuning into this large awareness, this pure awareness that can manifest and that can be also cultivated in different ways and can get more and more stabilized and be more and more what we live from. Not easy, but accessible. I wish we were coming next week, then I could say, okay. Okay. You have your assignment for next week? And we'll meet. Compare notes, okay?
When are you coming again? We can work on it until then.
Okay, yeah, I'm coming in April.
There you go.
Yeah, okay, so just do these practices for the next 3 months. Okay. So comments, questions, Veda, please. Where can I get the quote? I can send it, and I think there's a way of posting it.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. It's a great one, isn't it?
Yes.
It's very inspiring. Who should I send it to? What?
You can even understand it.
One can even understand that his instructions, yeah.
Yeah,
that's what my attempt was, to make this real accessible. Because these teachings, if I had tried to explicate the way this teaching is presented in the original text, might be some benefit.
We've done that.
We've done that, yeah. So I want to make it really practical, down to earth, and also let you know that you're already there, right? It's just a matter of doing what you're already doing a little bit more with a little more focus. This is accessible. It's profound, but it's accessible.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, please.
Will this talk be online available?
Yeah.
The one you're doing today?
Yeah, yeah, it's being recorded by, okay. by Art. Yeah. So the first two questions were very easy. Can I post the quotation and will this be online? Please, Patty.
You were here a few years ago when you introduced this thick and thin concept, and it was a very simple instruction to just notice when your ego is thick and notice when your ego is thin.
Yeah.
And I have found that very helpful.
Yeah.
Tonight you're giving us instructions for how to work with it when we find it.
Yeah.
And that's even more challenging, but more helpful. But I found it really interesting that you introduced this concept a few years ago.
Yeah.
And it's really helpful because it gets through all of the language of Buddhism. And just
right.
says, look at when you're all about you and look when you're not.
That's right, yeah. Try to make it down to earth. And, you know, I think I heard the metaphor of thin and thick from friends Tina Rasmussen and Steven Snyder, who I think used to live in San Rafael. And they're teachers of concentration. I did some retreats with them. And they use the metaphor, which I like a lot, so I want to credit them with that concept. But yeah, it's really, it makes the practice, again, it goes a long way, but it's simple in a way. Look for when the self gets thick. Study it. Or when we do that, there's a thinning that occurs. You know, it also is not always easy, you know. Or it's like some of you know, there's a passage from the Zen teacher, Dogen. He says, to study the Buddha way is to study the self. To study the self is to forget the self. To forget the self is to be enlightened by all things. That's another way of saying what I said, but maybe less accessible. Yeah. Please.
When you get in a negative state of mind,
yeah.
and that little wheel goes around, you
know, yeah.
Give me some ideas.
How to apply it. Yeah. When one gets in a negative state of mind, and the wheel goes around, that is maybe repeating that negative storyline or the negative thought over and over again. How to apply this practice, okay? So, yeah, I think about this because a lot of the teaching I do these days is on the theme of judgmental mind, which is, you know, may look, getting caught in being judgmental about self or another can look very much like what you're describing. And I think we could particularly work with the second and third practices. In other words, I'm really caught with something. If you can be mindful, there really are maybe three practices. If you're really stuck and you can't be mindful, do something which gets you out of being stuck. Very important. Because it's very important in all of this to know the difference between being able to be mindful of the thick self and being totally lost in the thick self. They are not the same, right? Sometimes we're totally lost and we think we're being mindful. But we're actually not. We're just, you know, we're just in the grips of the thick self, and every 10 minutes we come up for air, and we think that's mindfulness. Right? It's not really. And so we have to know that difference. And when we're totally lost with the thick self, we have to do things which get us out of the grips. And that could be many things. You know, loving kindness, when we practice a lot, has that power. Some of the heart practices have the power to be what we sometimes technically call antidotes. They shift us out of stuck places, right? So it could also be take a walk, do something physical, talk to a friend, get out of the house, whatever it might be. So we have to have a repertoire of ways to get unstuck, number one. Number two, if you can be mindful, study it. And we can't always be mindful, but when we can be mindful, study that sense of being somewhat caught, see what it feels like in the body, what's the storyline, what triggers it, where do you go? To know all those things and study them will help over time for one to recognize the stuck state earlier so one doesn't stay stuck so long. Mindfulness very clearly can work that way. Know it in the body. Sometimes you'll notice the stuck place in the body before you notice the storyline. So study all that so you get really familiar. That's secondary. And then third would be to do various thinning practices as well. You know, so if there is some really repetitive negative thought, it's good to do some compassion practice or loving kindness practice as well. I think looking at places we get stuck or caught where there might be some suffering, very important, I think, to bring the heart in and to be doing regular loving kindness practice. And regular means you do it 10 or 15 minutes a day, it goes a long way. So some different ways of thinning. It might be to, you know, just really track, be mindful, and so forth. Okay, thanks. It can help to have a support, you know, for have a buddy or someone who says, notice the thick self recently? Send an email. You know? Any appearances of the thick self? Can do something like that. Any other reflections or questions? It doesn't have to be a question, could it just be a reflection or something that comes to you? Please. You know? And maybe I'll do one more and then we'll go to the meta cards and see how. If we may have some time after that, but I want to leave enough time for that. Please.
Yeah, I was interested when you were talking about the zone, and I was thinking about, as a writer, that I've always felt that my best work happens, not I do it, when I feel like I'm channeling it.
Yeah.
And I never really thought of that in terms of the thinning of the self.
Yeah.
So it's almost like somebody else is doing it.
Yeah.
And I'm just there for it. So it's kind of interesting.
Yeah, it's beautiful.
But on the other side, there's a temptation when you're doing something, even not, I'm not talking about fictional writing, just writing.
Yeah.
Then you get attached to the process. It becomes very, and then there's a thickening because you identify with what you've written.
Yeah. So yeah, you can have this flow experience occur and think that it should keep happening or get attached to it or become self-conscious, like a, you know, a jazz musician who says, that was a great riff, wasn't it? You know, at that moment it's out of the flow, right? And so it's natural that that would occur, but yeah, just to see those experiences and just to see how that is and see where that appears in one's experience. How many of you can recognize some sense of flow in your work or creative activity or being with someone? It's pretty widespread, isn't it? Yeah. And, you know, I can certainly see it taking a teaching role, you know. And there's a process, you know, one has to go. I remember the first time I really spoke in public, I had a very thick sense of self. And of course, you know, we know from polls that public speaking is feared more than death by the American population, which means that there's a thicker sense of self related to public speaking than there is, the, you know, by the threat of annihilation. You know, 'cause obviously public speaking involves a threat of a certain kind of psychic annihilation, and then you live on to to remember it, which is worse than death. You just, after death, you, presumably you don't have to keep remembering what happened. But I know that in the teaching experience. You know, when I was the first time I did public speaking, I never had the experience of my knees knocking, but luckily I was sitting behind a desk something like this and my knees were just moving like about 2 feet. I didn't have the vocabulary. I didn't say, oh, there's the thick self. But it was like that. And in my own teaching, I've had, you know, it's very interesting to see where is the self thick, where is it more like just the experience of flow in teaching. I think we all know this in our own activities. So very, very interesting. You know, and so, again, my hope is partly that we can actually tune into these experiences that are very normal and natural, just, you know, whatever, washing the dishes, right? And see that, oh, let me just be with the flow here and appreciate it, or be with the sunset, you know, and so forth. And these are just as much opportunities for practice as the sitting meditation.